our raise strategy to get through to profitability. We are selling 10 million in secured convertible debentures backed by Bitcoin.
Okay.
And yeah, it's a big number, man. It's fucking keeping me busy.
Before we dive in, I want to share something with you. Now, these are brands I actually use in my own life. They aren't sponsors yet, but I believe in what they represent. If you're the kind of person who listens to T-Pow Labs or The Picture of Wealth, chances are you're already dialed into a few of these. But in case you're not, I have a few creative brand mentions. Gut Check, helping you decode your gut health so you can perform better from the inside out. What's the driver? Like, you always impress me with how much ambition you have for, you know, there's legacy for kids or that kind of stuff. What's the driver? Just complete curiosity?
In what way?
Well, it's like, this is a big project. You know,
yeah,
gonna
I mean, honestly, it wasn't when it started. And we started hiring people and it started growing. And the money, that money is just the amount of money that we need to get it off the ground and to do it properly. And the goal is we're going to transform the way people get paid.
Yeah, I love it. Tell me more.
Yeah, it's been a big journey. And when I started originally, my whole going back to the start of this thing, I got interested in Bitcoin in 2020 because I was trying to understand what money printing was going to do to fixed income. And the reason I was interested in fixed income, because at the time I was managing some pensions, and it just wasn't obvious to me like what we were actually supposed to tell employers that were offering different group retirement savings plan products. What is our take on where this is all going? And at the time, you know, what I didn't realize is I essentially had basically no understanding of money, how money works, what it is, how it's created, how money enters into the financial system, how assets become financialized. And so at a very early stage, I just thought there was an opportunity to create a product using Bitcoin that worked either alongside or competed with traditional savings plans. And the idea has grown a lot since then, as my understanding of the problem that we're trying to solve has also evolved. And so today it's much more an opinion that I think we're entering into a time where the conceptual understanding of what money is up for grabs and is going to be redefined. And we have lived, everyone who's alive today has lived in a time where money has worked a certain way and is mostly for operating under the assumption that the way things have worked previously over the last 50 or 100 years is the way things are going to work over the next 50 or 100 years. And I don't believe that anymore either. Yeah.
I love how you just set that up. Where do I want to go? Did you see in the last week or so, or maybe 2 weeks, that like a bunch of countries aren't trending towards USD pegging anymore, like Russia, Iran? I don't want to make this a political thing, but did you fact check that, or have you looked into that, or have you even seen that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of smoke there. Personally, I'm skeptical about any of the notion around a competitor reserve currency being created by countries. So the one you hear a lot about is BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China coming together to create some kind of a currency that could be used instead. And the issue there is a fundamental problem that actually caused the centralization of gold to happen in the Fed in the first place, is the auditability of reserve assets and countries' ability to prove that each of them has what they say they have. These are, you know, you're talking about Russia and China, for example, the idea that they're going to come together to create an asset-backed currency where they're going to, as part of that, have to create some kind of a mechanism of trust so that they can each feel comfortable that if it's gold, that the gold is there. I have a lot of doubts that is real. I do think that there's the dollar system is responsible for the current state of financial affairs and is obviously huge in how geopolitics phase out. When the United States made a decision to start freezing U.S. treasuries and Russian banks when the Ukraine war happened, I think that was a pretty strong signal that anybody who has any ambitions strategically that don't align with what the U.S. wants to do is going to have to find an exit out. And between petrodollar and the SWIFT banking system, you know, like most, the U.S. dollar is far and away the most held and used currency in the world. So that's something that I think will change. I personally and this takes a long place to get there. But I believe that we're in a place where the obvious answer, as you understand it better, is that it will be Bitcoin. And I think it's inevitable that, and this is why I actually believe today that it's pointless for the BRICS countries to try and create an alternate currency, because that alternate currency already exists and it works perfectly. It's just a matter of the rest of the world really hasn't caught up to that understanding yet.
What do you say to, again, when you meet people visceral about, to their core, about crypto, Bitcoin, and maybe I should say digital, this is evolving because there's altcoins, there's all these kind of meme coins and Trump coins and all this shit. But then there's, we're talking about just Bitcoin as like a store of value for someone, whether you want to collect gold or you want to collect Bitcoin, that people who understand that crypto asset, digital asset, are very passionate about it. And when I talk to people and it comes at me that they obviously know more than I do about it, I feel not compromised, but it's obviously I got to believe you. But where those people who have studied those digital assets maybe haven't studied the money system and how complex the money system itself is. So they don't actually have an either or and an understanding. So how, for me, teach me, Scott, how do I acquire that conviction about the actual money system is falling apart, opposed to just that the Bitcoin system is the end all be all future and you just got to believe me? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. So for talking about the money system itself, and this is kind of where I think fundamentally we have to understand that the rate of expansion of the money supply in any country and in every country is exponential. I think that one of the great sort of misnomers is that we've been conditioned to follow some relationship between inflation and what we're told is CPI. And CPI is an arbitrary measurement of a basket of goods that compares prices from a certain time until a different time. But it's fact that what they do with CPI is if the price of beef goes up too fast to skew the numbers, they have a mechanism in there to swap beef out for liver. And they can just assume that as a price of something rises too quickly, people will, in the free market, decide to start eating liver instead of beef. And that's not true, but that is how they manipulate that number. And so there are different ways of measuring the money supply. And there will be people listening who know a lot more about this than I do, but circulating supply of money is called M2. And M2 in Canada, since 1970, on average, gone up between 8 and 9% per year, which is to say that every 8 or 9 years, the total circulating supply of Canadian dollars effectively doubles. And so that's one piece. If you're considering what is the value, and this is an Austrian economics concept, the value of money relates to the value of the individual unit of the currency. So in this case, the loonie, the dollar, right? So the more they are creating, the less value the individual unit has. This is not wildly complicated.
And when you're saying what they're creating, you're not talking about printing money. You're talking about a human providing some output and getting paid. I think I want you to just...
Oh, sure. So I actually talk about creating money that didn't exist before. New money enters into the financial system in a number of different ways. And this is why the rate is what it is. So the Bank of Canada actually does create new money all the time. And they do it very good. This money isn't physically printed often. It's strokes of keys, right? Because one way that money enters the monetary system is through debt instruments, which then get purchased by banks and get loaned against. And another example is how commercial banks can actually, retail banks can create money by issuing loans for money that they don't actually have in reserve. So the banking system works on something called fractional reserve lending, which kind of means that retail banks can lend out a $10 for every dollar they have. So when someone goes to borrow $1 million to buy a house, the bank doesn't have to have that $1 million. But when that mortgage is created and the $1 million you are borrowing is paid out to the person who owned the house, that is $1 million that didn't exist previously.
Okay.
So that money now exists and it is in the system. There are more mechanisms than that, but just to kind of keep it simple, this is one part. And so I think So the second piece I think that matters is compounding is like the eighth wonder of the world for investing. And you know, you'll be telling your clients, people understand that you want to use compounding to your advantage. The earlier you start investing, the better off you'll be. And compounding works the same way when we're talking about the servicing of debt, and the government has to service debt in the same way individual people do. And so actually with Trump and the tariffs, so there's a lot of speculation that this is something that's been going on down there very much as well, is that some people feel that what they've been trying to do with the tariffs has been short-term drop in interest rates while they're about to refinance a bunch of government debt so that they can save on the interest expense. As the debt, as government debt grows, the cost of servicing that debt grows, and the compounding will be impacting that as well. And so the more debt that accumulates, the greater the cost of servicing that debt will be. And so this is where countries have been really, it's nonlinear. And I think the number in the US was, it took 200 years for the US to accumulate $1 trillion in debt. And they added $1 trillion to their debt last fall in like 90 days. This is compounding playing out in real time. And part of the issue is, it's been going on just slowly enough for just long enough that people haven't really, no one really who's alive today was an adult during the meltdown of the 20s that led into the Great Depression. There are lots of theories about longer economic cycles that relate to the expansion and contraction of credit, and which has to do with the debt ratios, government debt ratios. And lots of countries today are in sort of unprecedented, uncharted waters where the size of the debt burden and the growing expense associated with servicing that cost of that debt, it requires us to print more and more money. So that is one, it's a certainty that the money supply is growing much faster than inflation is reported. Two, the nature of compounding demands that governments are going to need to spend more and more money to service the debt that's already been accumulated. And no one's talking about, we used to actually talk about governments thinking about trying to pay down debt. And now we actually just try to talk about, could we in 5 years get to a place where the deficit spending budget is zero? And in Canada, it's gotten really horrific. This isn't a non-apolitical statement, but we don't really produce budgets on time anymore. When the federal government does produce a budget, they blasted way through it. Like last year, I think they were 60% over budget.
There's Christy Freeland, right, there's, totally.
Comrade Freeland. There's no mechanism for accountability. And so that's two. And then three is we need to really recognize the reality that the system itself actually requires the price of everything to go up forever, or it will collapse. It will become insolvent and collapse. And so this is just a reality. We know we want the price of our desirable assets to go up, because nobody would buy a $1 million house if they felt like it was going to be worth $600,000 in 20 years. So we actually do all want the price of assets to go up. The unfortunate reality that goes hand in hand with that is that the price of tomatoes is going to go up too. And the price of everything is going to go up. And so as money is continually created, governments continually tax and spend, and everyone is implicitly agreeing with this system, we're all signing up for money that is intentionally devalued over time as the result of an accelerating creation of more money. Like, none of this is opinion. This is all just how it works. And the likelihood, because of how compounding works, that this problem will accelerate is a near mathematical certainty. So another one of the lies we get spun out a lot is inflation is coming down, or inflation is getting under control. If you're gaining 5 pounds a month and you lose 3 pounds 1 month, but you're still 20 pounds heavier, you haven't got your weight problem under control. You have lost 3 pounds in 1 month. And so there's a lot of just total misdirection going on with trying to obfuscate the nature of what is happening, what is factually happening in the money system. And yeah, so if all of a sudden we did see prolonged deflation, people would be ruined, right? Because especially you look in Canada, we've really financialized real estate and people have gotten over their skis. And because of the belief that real estate is an asset is a way to become rich. And this is, I think, where people are really in for a rude awakening. And it's because what I actually believe is happening and what has happened over the last 20 years as we've seen waves of endless QE, and it's something that is happening around the world, right? Is people are actually hunting for assets which are appreciating in price faster than the currency we're using to measure it is melting. It's more obvious now that money does not go nearly as far as it used to. And it's not as abstract of a problem as it was for a really long time. When money was working better, price fluctuation was something that was annoying, but it was so much more gradual over the 2010s and previous, right? And now it's become a problem that's impossible to ignore. And you do find people are really talking about it. And this is how I think people get led to something like Bitcoin. And so if you believe that the market, what people are actually trying to do is protect themselves from a problem that they are aware of but don't fully understand. Ultimately, what matters is you need something that's going up fast. And if the Canadian monetary supply is going up between 8% and 9%, then you actually need assets that return like more than 12. Mm-hmm. Because if you're using the rate of monetary debasement as your measuring stick instead of whatever you believe CPI is, and you're going to pay some tax on gains if you make them, then if you're getting 7% or 8% or 9%, you're actually losing, and you're losing pretty fast. This is also, I think, something that's been mostly true. And I saw a presentation last week at a conference I was at in Orlando, and actually only 4% of companies outperform the S&P 500. So
4%.
It's very difficult, right? So we get to real estate, and this is has been one place over the last 20 years where people could reliably probably do better than 10. And for that reason, I think not only do people, they want that party to continue, even though it simultaneously is really making it impossible to just be alive in Canada. So then you have this non-physical asset that has been, depending on your time frame measurement, experiencing a compound annual growth rate somewhere between 40 and 60%. And we have not seen an asset reliably appreciate at a rate like that ever over an extended period of time. And for that reason, people want to believe it's too good to be true. They want to believe that was a symptom of Bitcoin being very early, and now that has changed and is unlikely to continue. So I think there are a lot of reasons Bitcoin meets people with. Nobody wants to be the person that has to acknowledge that we all had the same opportunity to learn about it for 15 years. And it just so happens that some people decided to spend the 50 or 100 hours earlier than others. Because what you find with Bitcoin is, if you take some time to really understand why it's doing what it's doing, most of the objections get removed with a minimal amount of work. And there's a great diagram. It's a Venn diagram that Bitcoiners like. There's a mechanism. There are a lot of really complicated mechanisms inside the Bitcoin software that make it run the way it does. And one of them is called the difficulty adjustment. And the difficulty adjustment is an auto-correcting system that makes sure that Bitcoins are mined at the appropriate pace over the next 120 years. So every 2 weeks, Bitcoin mining gets automatically on its own, easier or harder, depending on what had happened over the last 2 weeks of how fast Bitcoin was being mined. And what the diagram shows is basically there's two circles, and one of them is understands the difficulty adjustment, and the other is thinks Bitcoin is a scam. And there's essentially nobody in the middle who, if you have gone deep enough down the rabbit hole that you know what the difficulty adjustment is and how it works and why it matters, then you understand that you probably don't have really any material concerns about Bitcoin left. Yeah, I could stop there and let you back in, or I could keep going.
No, you're doing great. I think one of the things that I would ask is, where are you? Because you're talking to people, and I'm sure you'll get into block rewards, but this is gold that you're sharing, of like, where are people in the spectrum? We're at May 15th, 2025. Is it still back in 2020? It was everyone who got their $2,000 check from the government, re-COVID, very retail heavy, or you hear stuff that the government's going to adopt it. You hear stuff that there's all these new massive fund companies
But I heard there was fun companies coming on in 2020, but then, you know, it's like Bitcoin still went down. So where are people right now with, I love how you put that, because it's no one's in the middle. It's a scam, or it's, or you're convinced by it. What would bring more people into that middle pond?
Okay, I'm going to answer that, but let me go back and make one more point before I do. So we were talking about the financial system, and financial system's not broken. It's working perfectly. The nature of how that system works is by continually creating more and more money to create the appearance that people are getting rich while they're being... Inflation is valuable for governments because it devalues the debt that's being accrued from overspending in real terms. So it's an devaluing the currency is an important piece of how this all works. And so for people who understand that, and they're looking for assets that are outperforming Bitcoin, or outperforming the rate of monetary debasement, what they're probably not trying to do anymore is view it as trying to get rich. They're trying to protect the money that they've already made. And so in the current financial system, you really have to earn your money twice, because we understand that money will be worth less in the future. So we're all on this mission to go out and grow it. And what Bitcoin is instead is the opportunity to own the only form of money in the world that can't be arbitrarily diluted without consent. So you are taking money that you know is being diluted, and you're using it instead a place to store it that has a permanently fixed amount. And so for that reason, we can't know what the exchange rate between Bitcoin and the Canadian dollar will be over time. But what we're betting on is that over time, more companies and countries and individual investors will find value in being able to have an asset where they can seek refuge from monetary debasement, which I believe is the most pressing and critical financial problem of our time. And so it's not about, if you realize how severe that problem is, if inflation is 2%, you lose half your money every 36 years. If it's higher than that, and it is, you might be losing half your value every 5 years at 8 or 9%, right? It's a really important thing. Bitcoin is appreciating in price as more people are buying it, which is a reflection of probably more people understanding why it presents a potential solution to this problem. And it does digitize some of the most important features of gold. Scarcity. You need something. And if we exist in a world where we've acknowledged that there is an unlimited and never ending amount of money, then what we want are things that are rare. And in this case, nothing can be more rare than the one thing that we can absolutely never make any more of. We know exactly how many there are, how many there ever will be. And actually, because of the way blockchain technology works, we can identify where they all are, not physically, but where they are stored. And so Bitcoin is like a giant balloon. If you imagine like putting a balloon on a leaf blower and you're able to suck all of the air out of the Earth's atmosphere, and this balloon could expand forever. So we know that there will be a never-ending supply of new money until eventually it collapses. And every fiat currency does collapse. The average lifespan of a fiat currency is 22 years. And in other parts of the world, they collapse all the time. Like Peru, Lebanon, Turkey is in the middle of a prolonged hyperinflation cycle. Fiat currencies require the trust on central bankers to not overprint money. And every central bank overprints money. This is just how it goes. So that's a certainty too. And so this is why I think one way what we're observing right now, as the Bitcoin price has gone from $1 to $100,000 in 15 years, is just it's a measurement of the market getting more comfortable and more broadly understanding the serious nature of this very real problem. So where are we at with Bitcoin today? Part two. We had Bitcoin ETFs in Canada in 2020. They have been very successful. The US Bitcoin ETFs, led by BlackRock, who is the largest asset manager in the world, have been the most successful ETF launches of any product BlackRock has ever launched, and any ETF. And when gold ETFs were launched in the early 2000s, 2003, 2004, that sent the gold price wild. in a much slower time where direct investing was still really new. Like, things were very different back then, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Today, gold is, the market cap of gold is $17 trillion, and Bitcoin today is hovering around $2 trillion. So we have an asset that is compounding around 40 or 50%, that is today roughly 10% of the size of gold. And so there's a massive forward opportunity. If you're only thinking about Bitcoin as a competitor for digital gold, which it totally is not, it's much, much more than that. But even if it were only that, there would be potentially a lot of room and room in the near term. Price is like the most important recruiting factor for Bitcoin. And it becomes this like sort of self-fulfilling prophecy where Bitcoin will hit another number that will shock people. And that'll be 250,000 or 500,000, a million, 10 million, whatever. This is the same reaction other people had when Bitcoin hit 50,000 or 10,000 or 1,000. It's just, it's like watching some kind of phenomenon in nature that is like hard to make sense of when you're seeing it for the first time yourself. So what's going on right now that is really significant that very few people understand, and this is what was going on at this conference I was at last week. You mentioned these kind of companies. Some very large companies have and are now in the process of rolling out some very clever and ingenious strategies built around financializing Bitcoin and building financial instruments with the underlying asset being Bitcoin. And one of these companies, probably most famously, was called MicroStrategy, and they rebranded Strategy. So Michael Saylor is the CEO. Now he's the chairman of Strategy. And the very short story there was, it was 2020. They were a moderately successful 20, 30-year-old software company competing with MicroStrategy, Microsoft, and Business Analytics. And they had $500 million in cash. And that the value of that cash was being eroded away through money printing. And so they had to do something with it. They could have invested it back into their business. They could have paid it out in dividends. And these are what they ultimately decided to do was buy Bitcoin. And at the time, nobody understood why a company would want to own Bitcoin. But they were resolute in their decision and they kept buying. And now today they own a humongous amount of Bitcoin and they have started issuing secondary products that are adjacent to their Bitcoin position. So when they started buying Bitcoin, people started investing in the stock because there are a lot of institutional bodies that can't buy Bitcoin or Bitcoin ETF, but they could buy a proxy play like MicroStrategy. And right. So MicroStrategy has been the best performing stock in the US markets since the time they've started buying Bitcoin. So initially it was just the case that investors could get Bitcoin exposure now by buying MicroStrategy. And as the stock price went up and their market cap went up, they kept buying more Bitcoin. And then, which was driving the price of Bitcoin up. And it becomes this sort of positive feedback loop because they were buying significant amounts and billions. But what they've done now, in addition to that, is they're not just selling equity, and now they're selling debt instruments that also take advantage of Bitcoin's upward price movements. And they're not worried about the gold market now. They are coming after real estate investors. Commercial real estate investors oftentimes care more about cash flow than they do about actual real estate. And this has to do with this idea of finding investments that will outpace the rate of monetary debasement. So 6-8% cash flow, that's a good number in that space. And MicroStrategy has issued a claim on preferred shares, debt class instrument that perpetually pays a 10% dividend. And people are giving them money to buy Bitcoin and pay out a guaranteed 10%. And they have modeled this out in 1,000 different ways. And in 999 of them, this works. And they can perpetually issue a 10% yield on an asset that's compounding at 40 or 50%.
Right.
And so that market of commercial real estate investors is like 300 trillion. And remember, we're talking about Bitcoin is like all of Bitcoin is 2 trillion. And so what I think we're going to start to see copycat, and we have, there have been a couple very well-funded companies come out of the woodwork in the last sort of 2 months to say that they're going to start offering similar or competitor products. Like when you have an asset that's appreciating at this velocity, you're going to have the opportunity to do some really creative things. And So another point that they made in this presentation, if there's only 4% of companies that are actually outperforming the S&P 500, most of those companies probably should be buying Bitcoin instead of reinvesting and growing their own business. And it doesn't take many of them. Remember that Bitcoin is finite. So there is a inelastic relationship between the supply and demand. So if 50 S&P 500 companies had that idea, we're talking about a buy pressure on a very small asset that could produce a result that is really kind of mind-blowing. And I think there are bigger implications that are going to be forced as a result of this, because what they're really doing is promoting the notion that holding dollar-denominated anything on your corporate balance sheet is stupid, because we know for a fact that those dollars are being intentionally made worth less. And so if companies can consistently show that what you should be doing with any capital that you don't need to deploy immediately is hold it in Bitcoin, what we're probably looking at is a transformation of a number of different asset classes in the whole financial system. Because today, corporate real estate is another great example of some place companies might choose to try and put some money under the mattress to protect it. So a great way to diversify, hedge, would be buy the building you're in or the building across the street. And these things are just related to the value of money and the market's ability to bear the continued appreciation of those things. In the case of commercial real estate, and I think there's obviously some very major structural headwinds that have to do with things like AI, online shopping, work from home. The value of these things is going to look different. And this is a big Bitcoin idea. And it's the same for an individual investor as it is for a company like MicroStrategy. Bitcoin is a bearer instrument. And so the holder of Bitcoin is holding the asset itself. And when you transact in Bitcoin, it's a final settlement. So it would be like me giving you a gold coin. And at the end of the transaction, you have provable ownership of the gold coin. Whereas what we're doing in monetizing other asset classes and thinking of the money that we use as a vehicle to do other stuff with, to earn it again, we're adding a kind of a layer of abstraction to the financial system that might be not necessary anymore. So this notion of a digital store of value, I think it's a really important point. I'll try to just make it as clearly as I can. We're trying to store value. If money wasn't losing value at the rate that it is, we wouldn't be so worried about growing it. We used to save, like going way back, people actually used to save. We can't save anymore because that's a fool's strategy, because we know that money is becoming worth less and less all the time. And so what we've been doing over the last 50 or 100, 120 years is turning things into stores of value, because money itself can't store value. So when money can't do something, people will turn other things into money, right? And so we've turned houses into money. Like, you can't pay for a coffee with 1/100,000th of your house, but you can use it to as effectively as a bank account, right? Like, we're using it to protect ourselves from monetary debasement. Now, if all we're really trying to do is protect ourselves, then what Bitcoin is really doing is dematerializing the concept of store of value. So it's taking all of the desirable things you need this thing to do, and it's removed maintenance and tenants and who is the mayor in your town, and do you need to make a gamble or an educated guess on who the management of the company is, or all of these different things. It's a very elegant solution to the problem. And the real tricky thing about it is, if what people are really trying to do is find the thing that protects them the most, and there is actually one thing that is essentially engineered to do that better than all other things, then every investor or every person trying to protect their wealth actually has a binary decision to protect themselves using this thing that is actually functionally designed for that one purpose, or to try and continue risking, try to do better by owning other stuff, houses and stocks. And people who understand Bitcoin feel that what's going on right now is really sort of a hard money monetary singularity, where it's the apex design of a tool that is meant for protecting yourself from the erosion of the value of money. And it is better than houses to do that. And so as people understand that better, I think people will always own houses, but the idea of owning five houses instead of owning five Bitcoin is already today doesn't make any sense. And it's just that people, that idea hasn't diffused enough properly for the market to properly value these things relative to each other. And for that reason, I think we will think very differently over the next 30 or 50 years about the reason why you would own a house. And it will hopefully be transition to a place where it's a decision that you make because you want to have ownership of the house and not because you think that it's going to be the best way to outperform the certainty of government currency debasement. That has been solved, and people will instead allocate that capital to when they don't want to gamble. And this is where people get really crazy, because you think that Bitcoin is a risky thing, but it's actually probably the least risky thing you could do with your money today.
Well, I think as the guy who for 20 years has worn the risk hat, I see it. So the person has a business, they can make money in the business. I think you nailed the head when you talked about commercial real estate. Usually a commercial real estate person is buying the commercial real estate for some sort of yield, for some sort of, I like to drive by it, it's hard asset. But first and foremost, it's you want to make money. It's, you're not buying that for a bunch of more work, you know, and so you're putting the store of value. So I think where the person has to look at their allocation, if you look at a person with $1 million of investments in cash in their world, how much they believe in the Bitcoin way and how much they want to hedge sort of is the sliding bar that says this is what your allocation should be. You know, if you're like, kind of want to be relevant in my golf group on Wednesdays, I'll put in $5,000, or I'll put in 5%. I think currently as an advisor in the space, would 5% of assets, that'd be 50,000 on $1 million, is upwards of high for the masses currently. I think the allocation has moving though from 1-2% to 5%. And again, this isn't a buy or sell recommendation for anyone listening. This is entertainment and education. But I think 5% on a person who had $1,000,050, okay, if that went to zero, you're going to be annoyed by it, but it's not going to really affect your life.
So here's the thing, and this is often like a common way to phrase that, the risk of Bitcoin. And I think it's a great point to make. So where people get confused, I think, about Bitcoin is confusing the risk of the price being volatile over time with the likelihood that it might disappear entirely.
Mm.
And so anything is possible. A meteor could hit Earth tomorrow. This whole thing could be over. Outside of that, the likelihood that Bitcoin goes all the way to zero is about on par with the likelihood that the internet stopped existing.
Right.
So that it's already a bigger, it's a distributed network of computers that are all over the world working together to maintain and create an attack-resistant network. That network is bigger than the NSA and the CIA. It is a planetary financial machine and consuming a humongous amount of energy, which is a good thing. And so that's the sort of the structural physical part of it. The second piece is the internet is a series of protocols, and protocols are the language that computers use to talk to each other. So in creating the version of the internet that we use today, a number of different protocols have been adopted together in concert to create our sort of online experience. So SMTP is a protocol for email. HTTP, hypertext protocol for displaying dynamic web pages. Bitcoin is best thought of as the native payments protocol of the internet. It's a language computers can use so that we can send value online. And it is the result of 30 or 50 years of experiments in web technology and cryptography. There were lots of attempts at Bitcoin before the successful version happened. And what Bitcoin did that separated itself from the previous attempts was solve something called the double spend problem, which is how do you prevent fraud or multiple spending of the same dollar in an online environment where the actors don't know each other? You have to be able to create trust by fraud proofing the system. And it was solving that very complicated technical problem that birthed a finite currency. And so what Bitcoin actually is now is the world's only monetary system that is borderless and has verifiable properties, like auditable properties. And so these things represent actually a step function improvement in currency, because what we really want more than anything from money is for it to work, right? Like, money is a technology that evolved to solve something called the coincidence of wants, which is basically like, we can only barter if you have turnips and I have milk and we happen to want the thing that the other one has, right? And so that doesn't work very long. You get to a certain size. But really, like, money itself should just be a medium that allows us to store the fruits of our labors and exchange that with other people so that we can all have the stuff that we need. This is something that is, because we don't have any say in the money that we use, this inflation piece, which has also been spun as a complete fugazi, the idea that the monetary system needs to continually expand as some kind of like lubricant of a healthy economy. It's just theft. Like, it is actually a non-consensual and indirect form of taxation, which is completely obfuscated. And it's done by design, because, you know, this idea is like, it's a 2% inflation, because if a mouse was eating 2% of the food out of your fridge, that might be just a small enough number that you would go a really long time without noticing. But if it's 10% of your food, all of a sudden you're going to have the mouse traps out, right? So yeah, so I think maybe just to put a bow on that, likelihood of Bitcoin disappearing is tiny. And so what you're actually doing when you're trying to right size a Bitcoin position in your portfolio, what you should be thinking about, if you believe any of what I've been saying over the last like half hour, you're actually taking a risk in thinking that real estate as a store of value is going to continue to be able to compete with something that has been engineered to be better at the thing that is the reason why you're owning real estate in the first place. And that is actually much riskier than most people understand. So the same thing, if you have a 5% allocation to gold, I think there's a very real chance that in the near future, gold is only used for jewelry and like electronics. And so if you bet wrong there, then you're really, it's significant. So there is a very real cost to waiting on learning about Bitcoin as the Bitcoin price continues to compound at the rate it has. And if the Bitcoin thesis plays out to be true, it's actually like musical chairs, where the only chair you would want to be sitting on is the one that actually only exists online.
Scott, that's amazing. So I do want to give you a chance to, I'm personally curious about it, just to close us out with what's going on at Block Rewards and what, you know, you guys are actually doing for business owners and for the world. Again, I know what the concept is. We met a little while ago, but I know it's evolving all the time. Where is your company at right now?
Thanks. Yeah. So I think that when I started to really, my background is compensation and benefits, and I understood Bitcoin. I'm like, oh, this would be a really cool like perk. You know, maybe employers might be interested in offering this to younger staff. And then, you know, it's taken me years to get to the place where I could talk about it like this, but I'm confident most people are going to catch up. What I believe people really want is peace of mind that comes from being able to plan for the future with certainty. And the easiest way to do that is by saving your money in the hardest form of money that has ever been invented, and that is Bitcoin. And the understanding that actually allows you to exit yourself from the more complicated and, to be honest, like much more stressful investing strategies that we've normalized as a result of the rate of having to deal with the rate of inflation and the escalating cost of living. So Block Rewards is a first of its kind tool. We want to empower employers to think about, seriously about, including Bitcoin in their compensation reward stack. And it could be as a novelty, but we're taking it much more seriously. So I believe today Bitcoin is already the most important thing employers need to understand, because it is today the most valuable thing an employer could offer their staff. And I say that just based on the historical performance. It's the best performing asset ever, factually, in the lifetime that it's existed. But yes, at a certain point, whether that's 15 years, 20 years, companies should be thinking about how they may be able to leverage that asset to create some exciting and differentiating aspects to how they think about recruiting and retaining staff. So our tool is designed to make that as easy as possible. It works if you have 5 employees. It works if you have 500. And we enable various kinds of Bitcoin purchase to happen through payroll. So it could be an optional conversion of someone's a part of their paycheck to Bitcoin. It could be an employer gifting people Bitcoin as a reward or as a reason for them to start learning about Bitcoin. We see this with customers today where executives are Bitcoin investors and Bitcoin optimists. And it could be some combination of the two, where the employer is thinking about Bitcoin like any other benefit they might offer and engaging with their staff to build a savings plan. Like with RSPs, it's normal the employers will contribute a match that meets this staff where they're willing to save. And I think that Bitcoin has a very important role to play in how we think about paying people. And for companies, the same problems that affect like the COGS and input costs of a business affect wages. So everybody needs to get X raise at the end of the year. And we don't think about this either, but what we're really trying to do is address the eroding value of money. And so the easiest thing to do, as counterintuitive or crazy as it might sound, is start just thinking about paying your staff in a form of money that actually works properly. And that's the idea.
Awesome. Scott, where can people find more information on you or what you're up to?
We are Canada only right now, so you can visit us at blockrewards.ca. Happy to chat anytime. I'm very active on LinkedIn, and so you can find me there. And we have a For Beginners Bitcoin podcast. New episodes release every Tuesday. When we get experts from all aspects of the conversation. It could be macroeconomics, the technology, the social side of Bitcoin, employer-focused stuff, and that's on all the major YouTube and Spotify, and that podcast is called The Block Reward. Yeah, those are probably the best places.
Awesome, Scotty. Thanks a lot for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.